Cancer Advances, a Cleveland Clinic podcast for medical professionals, exploring the latest innovative research and clinical advances in the field of oncology. Thank you for joining us for another episode of Cancer Advances. I'm your host, Dr. Dale Shepherd, a medical oncologist here at Cleveland Clinic, directing the TOSIC Early Cancer Therapeutics Program and co-directing the Cleveland Clinic Sarcoma Program. Today, I'm very happy to be joined by Dr. Allison Winter, an associate staff here at the Cancer Institute working in the Lymphoid Malignancies and Cellular Therapy Programs. She is here today to talk to us about innovations in chronic lymphocytic leukemia treatment. So, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So, and incidentally, you've had a couple of other episodes that people can look up and listen to still.
I have indeed.
So, remind us, what do you do here at the clinic?
So I work in our lymphoid malignancies department, which means I specialize in lymphomas as well as some chronic indolent leukemia such as CLL and hairy cell leukemia. I'm also a member of our cellular therapy program where I mostly do autologous stem cell transplant as well as CAR T cell therapy and bispecific therapies.
Excellent. Well, we are going to focus today on chronic lymphocytic leukemia. And so we're going to talk about some of the newer things going on. So lots of different people might be listening in, may have a little bit different of historic perspective. Give us an idea kind of where we've come from in terms of treatments.
The treatment for CLL has evolved over the last decade. I remember when I started in training, there was still a lot of use of chemotherapy. And since the approval of ibrutinib, which was one of the first novel therapies for CLL, it's a BTK inhibitor, things have rapidly shifted in terms of treatment. So I almost never use chemotherapy at this point, and I'm using novel agents right up front for the first-line treatment.
And tell me a little bit about what are some of those novel treatments? What are some of the, you mentioned the BTK inhibitors. Those are still really important. What other things are we looking at?
BTK inhibitors are still very important. We started with the approval of ibrutinib, but we now have several other BTK inhibitors on market. So the second generation BTK inhibitors include acalabrutinib and zanubrutinib. And then more recently, we have a non-covalent BTK inhibitor, which was just approved for CLL in the last year. These drugs are still very important, but we also have novel agents such as venetoclax, which is the BCL2 inhibitor that's currently commercially available. And then we often still combine some of these therapies with things such as monoclonal antibodies, most notably rituximab and obinutuzumab. What I think is really interesting is how we have pretty much gone to using just novel therapies in the frontline setting. And we're shifting towards trying to go back to time-limited therapy. So years ago when patients had chemotherapy, it was only so many cycles and patients were able to come off of therapy. So now our focus in CLL in the frontline setting is coming back to how do we do time-limited therapy and get patients off of treatment for some time.
And I guess just to be really, really clear with everyone kind of listening in, when you say time-limited therapy, what exactly are you talking about?
Good question. So generally when I'm treating a CLL patient for the first time, I consider two approaches. So one is to do a BTK inhibitor, usually as monotherapy. There are a couple instances where I might add something like obinutuzumab in. So it's usually monotherapy. And with the BTK inhibitor monotherapy strategy, we really need to do indefinite therapy. We need that continuous inhibition. The other strategy I'll use is what I referred to as time-limited therapy. So commercially available is venetoclax plus obinutuzumab. And the reason it's called time-limited therapy is because after a combination of 12 months, patients are able to stop both drugs entirely and just go back to the monitoring phase.
And what sort of drives that ability to stop treatment? So oftentimes we think you have a tumor, you're suppressing something, you're sort of minimizing risk if it comes back, even if your scans look good. What's different about this disease? What's different about these drugs that allow us to do that?
So when we're doing the BTK inhibitor monotherapy, we're not getting deep enough remissions where we're able to stop therapy. When we're doing a venetoclax-based regimen, we are getting deeper remissions. We're able to get MRD undetectable states, which is why we're able to stop therapy.
Okay, so I'm going to just throw out there, I'm very jealous. because you talk about a deep remission, and I don't, as a sarcoma guy, get to get remissions much at all. So deep remission, well, how are you defining deep remission?
So this is where the strategies are changing. So for commercially available venetoclax plus obinutuzumab, I do get MRD testing at the beginning because I use clonoSEQ where I have to get ID testing. And then I do get it at the end of the combination 12-month therapy, but I don't necessarily dictate what I do. I stop at that point because that's how the trial that got that combination approved was run. But we're using this technology to shape future studies where the stopping usage is determined by the MRD status. So like I said, in the venetoclax obinutuzumab CLL14 study, everyone's just stopped at 12 months, regardless of MRD status. But newer studies are stopping whether or not, based on whether or not they're MRD undetectable. And when I say deep remission, I mean people come off therapy for years. So
it's a long time.
Long time. Yeah.
And when we think about MRD testing, what are we using in CLL for MRD testing? Is it PCR? Is it what technology do we use in CLL?
Yeah, so there's two different strategies. So you can do it by NGS testing or by flow cytometry. I have, in clinical practice, used the NGS technology with the clonoSEQ assay, and a lot of the studies that I've participated in are using that assay as well.
So tell us a little bit about the MAGIC trial.
The MAGIC trial is an international study. It's a frontline CLL study. And what's interesting about this is it's looking at two different combinations. One is with the BTK inhibitor acalabrutinib combined with venetoclax. And the other arm is what you may consider standard of care because it's venetoclax plus obinutuzumab. It's not exactly standard of care, though, because, again, standard of care, you just stop at 12 months regardless of MRD. So on this study, you have to have the combination of the two drugs for at least a year. So the length of time is a little bit different based on the lead-in times with the combination drug. But after a year, MRD is tested. And if a patient's MRD undetectable, they get to stop both drugs. But if MRD is still detectable, then they can go on to receive treatment for an additional amount of time, up to an additional year. So it's a pretty exciting combination. And there are pros and cons to each arm. And I think it's going to be really exciting to see how it pans out. We have accrued a number of patients here at Cleveland Clinic. And we're getting to the point where many people are getting to that 1 year of therapy and starting to get their MRD testing. So it's currently closed. The entire study has reached the accrual.
It's pretty good. When you think about, you say pros and cons of the arms, what are the kinds of things that you think about?
Yeah, that's a good question. So for instance, the acalabrutinib plus venetoclax arm, one of the pros is the acalabrutinib is oral and the venetoclax is oral. So it's an all oral regimen. One of the pros of the venetoclax plus obinutuzumab arm is the obinutuzumab does a pretty effective job of debulking patients. So when I start the venetoclax, I almost always can do that as an outpatient. One of the things we worry about with venetoclax is tumor lysis syndrome, and the higher the disease bulk, the higher our worry is for tumor lysis. So in the past, and even sometimes still, we do have to bring patients into the hospital to do that. But again, with the VO arm, I'm usually able to debulk them enough with just a couple doses of the O that I can do the venetoclax as an outpatient.
You talked about how you get a year of therapy, you start looking for MRD. How do you know when someone needs to restart? Are you using MRD as a criteria to resume therapy?
We are not using MRD as a criteria to resume therapy in clinical practice or even on that study. So that can be a little challenging if you do have an MRD test that is undetectable even at the end of therapy. Say you do VO and your MRD is still detectable at the end. There's some controversy about what we should do with it because that's not how the study was done. So I don't resume therapy or I don't not stop therapy based on that. It's really a clinical relapse that you would restart therapy.
And not being a CLL guy.
Yeah.
You know, in a lot of diseases, you know, earlier detection, earlier treatment, you know, there's a lot of debate about, you know, is it really reasonable to expose people to toxic therapies and costly therapies and medicalize their life when you don't really know that it has to be treated? You know, what are we using as a criteria to resume if we're not doing MRD?
Mm-hmm. So if we rewind and just think about CLL, there are many people who are watched. I mean, that's the standard of care when you're diagnosed with CLL is to wait and initiate treatment when there is what we call a treatment-related indication. So if you come off of therapy, you might see the lymphocyte count going up. That's signs that the CLL is progressing, but you might not necessarily need to start treatment if none of the treatment-related indications are there.
And I guess on the backside of that, it begs the question of whether people have bulky disease and they're symptomatic because they have bulky disease. Do we necessarily think we need to treat them until, you know, you reach a certain MRD level, or is simply debulking with these newer drugs maybe enough and you can stop therapy earlier?
So if you have symptomatic disease...
So I guess I'm thinking of a world where you have bulky symptomatic disease, you've started these newer drugs, you may have knocked the tumor down to, you know, where perhaps your scans look great, you still have detectable disease through a blood test.
Yeah.
Do you really need to keep treating all the way down to a certain level of minimal residual disease, right? Are we treating too long?
Yeah, I don't think that's the case right now with CLL. There have been some different studies out there looking at the different MRD, like if you're saying 10 to the minus 5 versus 10 to the minus 6, and how they relate to outcomes like progression-free survival. And we do know that basically the deeper you are, the longer your progression-free survival is going to be, which I think is important because patients want to get off therapy and stay off therapy for a decent amount of time after they've gone through a year of combination therapy.
Other therapies coming around, where are the gaps, where are the exciting other new therapies?
So in CLL, there's an important term that most of us are using now called double refractory. This is a group of patients who've seen both a BTK inhibitor as well as a BCL2 inhibitor, usually venetoclax. So people who are double refractory definitely need agents if they progress after these two. This is an unmet need in CLL. There are some future things coming. So for instance, pirtobrutinib was FDA approved just in December for CLL patients. And this is a BTK inhibitor, but what's different about this is it's a non-covalent BTK inhibitor. So even if you become resistant to a traditional covalent BTK inhibitor, including ibrutinib, acalabrutinib, zanubrutinib, you can still have activity again with this non-covalent BTK inhibitor, pirtobrutinib. So that was very exciting to see that approval. Most of us are looking forward to, there's a PDUFA date for CAR T-cell therapy with liso-cel coming up this month for CLL. And then there's newer agents, newer molecules that are already in clinical trials. For instance, we're involved with a company called Nurix, which is looking at targeting BTK, but in a different mechanism. So this is a molecule that's a BTK degrader. So there's still exciting stuff out there that are going to fill the gaps for those patients who are what we call double refractory.
So just to, because it's not intuitively obvious to me, a non-covalent BTK inhibitor is better in what way? Because it seems like covalent sticking to something may be better. What's the attraction of a non-covalent inhibitor?
So a lot of people who progress on ibrutinib, acalabrutinib, or zanubrutinib will have certain mutations that we can pick up, like a mutation in the BTK binding site. So this still has activity even with those mutations present. So this is reversible, where the other ones are irreversible.
All right, excellent. And of these new agents, we have trials going on here at the Cleveland Clinic?
We do. So we have, like I said, there's the BTK degrader that we have available. We also have other CAR T therapy trials going on, which I think are still going to be useful, even if liso-cel does get approved. And then there's some other strategies out there looking at the bispecifics in CLL, ROR1. There's some other exciting stuff to look forward to.
So CLL is... there's a fair amount of patients in terms of numbers of patients. Who should seek a second opinion here at the Cleveland Clinic? Think about these novel therapies. There's so many things out there now. Who's best to be seen for a second opinion when, in terms of the course of therapy?
A lot of patients with CLL will initially be managed with active surveillance. And I think that's, you don't necessarily need to have a second opinion, although I do find a lot of patients find it useful to come just to get a really thorough education about what to expect in the years to come. I would say if a patient is getting to the point where they need to start therapy, that's a good time to get a second opinion, because there are changes in what we have to offer for the frontline setting and differences in opinions and pros and cons. And it's sometimes helpful to make sure you're getting the pros and cons and all the options, because unlike some cancers, there may not be a choice. You know, when I treat diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, there may be just one option that I think's best, whereas CLL, I lay out a couple options and I give the pros and cons. And then I think those patients who, especially if you're double refractory, going around and seeing second opinions for various options. So sometimes a clinical trial might be opened at one location, but not another. And getting the information to figure out which one might make the most sense would be helpful.
Very good. Lots of exciting things happening. Very interesting approaches. Appreciate your insight.
Yeah, no problem. Glad to be here.
To make a direct online referral to our Cancer Institute, complete our online cancer patient referral form by visiting clevelandclinic.org/cancerpatientreferrals. You will receive confirmation once the appointment is scheduled. This concludes this episode of Cancer Advances. For more podcast episodes, visit our website, clevelandclinic.org/cancer advances podcast. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for listening. Please join us again soon.